with one of the most famous faces and voices at the BBC, Jeremy Vine. He's hosted everything from Panorama to Eggheads. His Radio 2 phone-in show has an audience of 7 million. You see, they give his figures out. They won't give my figures out, but they give his figures out. And he's turned his hand back to writing now, and there's a new book out. It's called What I Learned, What My Listeners Say, and Why We Should Take Notice. Maybe I should write a book like this. Jeremy's with me this morning. Good morning, Jeremy.
Stephen, yeah, you probably should.
Good morning, good morning.
Good morning.
Why did you write this in the first place then?
I'll tell you what happened. I was actually sitting in a coffee shop round the corner from Radio 2 a couple of years ago, and I'd been through the whole Strictly thing, and I was thinking, I should think of some life lessons here. And my first thought was, how many calls has my show taken since I took over from Sir Jimmy Young in 2003? And I did this little formula to do with the weeks in the year and the number of calls per show and so on, and I realised I had taken roughly 24,910 calls, and I thought, gosh, I've only got about another 90 before I hit 25,000, and I thought I need to try and work out what these listeners are all saying, what they care most about, and what it all means.
And we'll get to that in a second or two. But you mentioned there when you took over from Sir Jimmy Young, was that a wobbly time for you? Were you certain you could go in and make that show as good, if not better?
Oh, it was wobbly, really, because I think I was. It's a bit like Man on Wire going between Newsnight and Radio 2. It was quite a stretch. And at the time on Newsnight, obviously Paxman was the main man there, and it was hard. I was also called Jeremy, which is rather inconvenient. Yeah. So when Radio 2 came up as an opportunity, I thought, that's a good idea, and I've always loved music. But I then discovered that, you know, as I listened to it, I realised that firstly, Jimmy wasn't going willingly. And of course, sadly, we lost him about 6 months ago. He died. And secondly, you're taking over from somebody who is such an institution that he's actually been the subject of a Pink Floyd song. And he'd been doing it for 29 years. So how long do you need before you actually are the replacement? It's not 6 weeks, it's probably six years.
And did you just get to the stage by that stage where you were sick being Paxman's number two? Did you feel you could oust him, or did you feel you were as good as him?
Well, it's funny. I a few years ago, I wrote a memoir about the BBC, and I had a whole chapter on being Paxman's number two. And I had come to the conclusion that the stand-in never gets the show. I mean, that's the key BBC rule, is that if you're standing in for somebody, when they go, for whatever reason, you will never be the main presenter. So I kind of worked that out for myself. But actually, you know, the funny thing was, when I came to Radio 2, and it's probably, we've got a lot in common, Stephen, as we often discuss when we talk to each other. The joy of just even the discussion I've just heard you have there, the rawness and the reality of a live conversation without spotlights and makeup, I think there's something truer about radio. And when you connect with your listeners, it's just sheer joy.
It's an incredible feeling, isn't it? Radio, I find it hard to describe, actually, because I do telly, I do radio, but there is... It's actually more than a knife-edge radio somehow, and especially then if you're doing a phone-in, because there is so much control, as you know, around television and so much pre-planning. And if the BBC actually thought about it, callers coming on air, saying what they want to say, and you're dealing with it in a live environment. That's brilliant, but it can be scary.
Yeah, and that's right, but that's part of the truth and part of the reality. And the reason I as I started to write, I was really writing about how do we know what's real? And I think once you put makeup on somebody and you shine you bring spotlights into their front room and say, okay, we'll start taping in 10 seconds, you don't really get who they are. And the same is true, sadly, with a lot of politicians. But there's something about the caller who rings up. And of course, since I did my 25,000 calculation, we've then had Brexit and we've had Trump, and we realize the tables are turned on the pundits and people like us who thought we were presenting a show and they were listening. Now we realise that our callers know what's going on and we've got to find out from them. So the Newsnight model, which I totally believed in at the time, which is that you get six or seven clever people in an office and they decide what the news is, has really gone, I think. I think we don't know what's happening until we say, you tell us.
Well, does that suggest that there is a disconnect between the media and what's happening, and that you need callers? Jon Snow was talking about this, wasn't it, the Edinburgh Fringe, that there is a disconnect with some
For
parts
sure.
of the media. Do you think there is?
At the centre of this book is the idea that we are moving away from expertise as the touchstone and moving towards experience. So just to give you an example, and you'll immediately understand this, two or three weeks ago, somebody said to me, we're doing an item on psychopathy, what it's like to be a psychopath. We've got two potential guests. We've got a professor of psychology, or we've got a psychopath. Now, which one would you choose? You know, when we do an item on Lyme disease, we have a woman who's had Lyme disease for 10 years because she's an expert in her own condition. Now, I know that can lead us into trouble. You can end up getting somebody on the air who says they're absolutely certain the world is flat. But my goodness, we have had so many expert botch-ups in the last 10 years, I've lost count. Not least the fact that for the last 50 years, we've been told that fat makes us fat, and we're suddenly told, oh, sorry, we got that wrong. You can eat more than 2 eggs a week. It's all to do with sugar and refined carbohydrates. And we've had the wrong dietary advice for half a century, and we got an absolute worldwide plague of obesity as a result. And that's just one thing.
To come back to that disconnect, why do you think there is a disconnect then from people working in the media, from some people working in the media, and what's actually happening on the ground? What's going on there?
I don't quite buy the Jon Snow thing, which is the idea that you know, the presenters have become disconnected and therefore the shows aren't as real as they should. Because I just don't think presenters matter as much as we think we do. So Jon Snow's...
Why do we charge so much then?
Well, good question. I mean, Jon Snow's prescription is if we can all get closer to our audience, then we will start doing the news in a way that's more vivid and real. I don't really buy that. I think the key thing is just like what you do, is to open the doors and the windows and ventilate the show and say to the listeners, look, this is your show. You tell us what's going on. And, you know, I was really struck, Stephen, when we were doing the whole run-up to Brexit. We had an item, you'll remember the story about, did the Queen support Brexit? And then we had a royal expert on who said, you know, almost certainly she didn't. And then this caller called Phyllis Capstick from Sheffield rang and she just said, listen, I'm absolutely certain she does. We need to vote for Brexit. And I said, but what about the royal expert? And she said, Jeremy, experts built the Titanic. And I thought, gosh, I'm going to really remember that as a moment where the experts and the pundits got upended. And I spend every election, as you know, in the election Dimbleby velodrome place with my graphics. We've been wrong time after time there. We thought Hillary Clinton was going to win the American election. How we've got everything wrong. It's amazing.
You said if you listened to Radio 4, Brexit was a shock. If you're a Radio 2 listener, it wouldn't have surprised you at all.
Was that
a dig at Radio 4?
No, not really. I think
sounds like one.
Well, I mean, Radio, bless them, I love the Today programme, where I started working, but it is the old model, which is, you know, it's. And I'm glad that not every show is a call-in show, so long may this continue, but you will have politicians on saying what they think and important people, and we do still have experts and important people, and I think that's absolutely right. I'm just saying that when you start to bring on first-person experience more, with certain things, you may get a better pointer about what's happening. And I think with Brexit, you did. If you listened to my show, probably your show as well, you would be aware that we are quite possibly heading towards Brexit. I think if you listened to the establishment on Radio 4, then you probably wouldn't be. But it's different models of broadcasting, isn't it? That's what's so interesting.
Yeah, you talk also in the book, Jeremy, about intergenerational warfare, that older people, that dynamic between the older audience and the younger audience. What do you mean?
Well, I somebody said to me, what's the main issue on your show? And I thought, gosh, that's great, because I've got to have an answer to that. If you're writing a book, you need to have an answer. There are things like cycling and angling that drive people nuts. But I said, I think the biggest single issue that comes out of my show, and it comes into so many subjects, is what I would call intergenerational warfare, which is, firstly, well, I tell you, when it first came out, Stephen, we had a guy called George on in his early 20s, and he said, look, we're really struggling with student loans, we can't buy property, we need a windfall tax on the older generation, on pensioners, because they're relatively rich. He said the older generation had free education, cheap as chips housing, jobs for life, pensions, holidays, unsustainable amounts of NHS attention. And then somebody else rang in and said, yes, and they destroyed the planet on the way out. And at that point, then the older listeners got in touch and they were furious to hear this, because they said, what we see with the younger generation is they want a flat screen TV before they've got a job. They didn't fight in the war. They've never had to scrimp and save. They worship people like Kim Kardashian instead of Yates. And they would never use an outside toilet. And they also drink, you know, a bottle of wine every 2 days instead of one a month. And that disconnect between those two generations is so massive now. And
isn't it always going to be the case, though?
No, but I think it's, well, the figures suggest that we've stopped this ramping whereby the next generation can look forward to being richer than the last. And that's never happened before. That we've now got a situation where grandchildren are going to be poorer than their grandparents unless something unusual has happened in their family. And the question is how you sort that. And of course, I mean, one of the fascinating things about politics is that we saw younger voters stay away from Brexit because they were maybe a little bit complacent. Brexit then happened. Younger voters blamed the older generation. And then they got on board in the 2017 election and they gave Jeremy Corbyn a massive rocket and a boost. So we've seen suddenly younger voters engage with the political process, but too late for Brexit from their point of view.
The book is called What I Learned, What My Listeners Say and Why We Should Take Notice. And of course, you never know when a caller comes on what they are going to talk about. And there are some times when you're doing phone-in shows when you are the news and I am the news. And so it goes, like this example.
Hello, you can say whatever you want.
Yeah, let me first say I enjoy your programme and I enjoy you personally. But I'd like to ask you a direct question. Are you embarrassed to pick up your paycheck?
Do you know, I just feel very lucky every day, is the answer to that.
I do think you're overpaid.
I don't even really want to answer that because I feel like it's not the moment for me.
You spend your lifetime asking people questions.
Yeah.
Now I'm asking you a direct question.
I think...
Do you think the rest of the BBC, the staff, Claudia Winkleman, Chris Evans, all them, do you think they're grossly overpaid?
Some are.
Because
Were you cringing?
Brilliant. No, do you know what? That's the heart of my show, that call. I mean, that I said to the producer before the item, whatever happens, you mustn't put through a load of people who support me. And if it doesn't matter who it is, I will never blame you. If he's tough, if he's angry, if it's a she and she's furious, it doesn't matter. So
I need to get your producers. I don't need to tell my producers that. They do it anyway.
But, you know, it just shows I can ask questions, but I'm not very good at answering them. I still haven't really got an answer. I suppose the answer is I'm overpaid compared to my mother, who was a doctor's receptionist, or my father, who was a college lecturer. But those figures suggest I'm underpaid compared to the guy who does the Radio 2 breakfast show. I don't know.
Were you surprised to see what other people were on?
Well, I was told by a couple of people that I was 15th on the list, and then someone else said I was 11th. So I thought, okay. And so when it came out that I was fourth, I was really shocked. And my first thought, funnily enough, Stephen, was that the BBC's obviously managed to successfully clamp down on presenter pay if it's got me in fourth place. but I think the overriding ongoing story is the gender gap, which as a father of two young girls concerns me as much as anybody. So I don't know how they sort that out. And I think the key thing to remember about the list, which you were on as well, is that it is a snapshot and those figures are out of date already. And also they missed a number of names out. So I think there needs to be some action taken to see what everyone gets.
What do you mean?
Well, because we...
Action taken with...
Well, in the sense that there are presenters who... I don't know if you do... Have I Got News for You? If you're the presenter, I noticed David Dimbleby's not on it. There are names that are not on the list. So it seems odd to have a partial list. So maybe they need to work out how they get all the names on it.
And do you think while there is a partial list, it's unfair?
You know what? It's just one of these things. I certainly haven't blamed the BBC for it because I think that in the end, the BBC got a great deal on charter renewal and they said, oh yeah, okay, we'll do that. And it was a bit like a poison pill inside that they didn't quite notice. And it turned out to have all kinds of repercussions.
What's the hardest telephone call you've ever dealt with?
I think it was a pensioner who said that, she'd been raped at the age of 12, and I said, who have you told? And she said, you're the first. And I thought, that isn't it incredible that the intimacy of that call where she's almost just speaking to me? And I'm quite an emotional person, so I can get quite tearful when I'm on a call like that. And I just was listening to her, and I was thinking, I don't really know what I'm supposed to say here at all.
It's humbling, isn't it? It's humbling when someone trusts you to that extent.
Very much. And we've done two series now called The Songs My Son Loved. And the latest one was just a couple of months ago. And it was mums of sons who've died, soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, but remembering them through the music they loved. And I went and traveled to see these mums in their homes and to really get a biography of their darling sons who were, you know, 23, 24, sometimes just 19 years old when they died. And to have them sort of portrayed through their music that they loved, which is obviously in some cases quite raucous, was extraordinary. I don't think I'll ever get closer to the rawness of grief than I did in those conversations with those mums and their bravery in talking about it and trying to deal with it, which in a way they, I don't think they ever can.
Where do you want to take the show next? Or is it where you want it to be and that's it? And what ambition is left in you? You're all over the telly. You're on the, in my view, you know, one of the best radio stations there's ever been Radio 2. It's an incredible station. What's next? Are you happy to tread water in a good way?
It's not treading water, because once you do that, if somebody says that show is fine, I think, oh, no, fine is no good. You've got to leave the station every day thinking that was unbelievable, that show.
That's hard, 5 days a week.
It is hard, but usually there'll be one item. You know, the day we were talking about building a garden shed, and the producer said, let's build a shed in the studio. And the guy built the shed and went away, so it stayed in radio. Simon Mayo had to look at it for 2 hours. So all the Shetland ponies that came in the studio, or, you know, to talk about the children's Shetland pony Grand National or whatever. So there's all kinds of things that we can do with 2 hours of airtime. And 2 hours of airtime is a blank canvas. So I don't think changing the canvas isn't what I want to do, really. I'm happy. I'm delighted that Radio 2 give me this chance. I'm amazed that, you know, I'm in awe of Jimmy Young, that he was doing it at the age of 83 when my granny was in a nursing home, doing 2 hours of live radio a day. It's just incredible. So I think you're right, you know. I don't think there's anywhere better. People say, what do you want to do next? And I just say, I want to do this next. And I can see out this little door here at Wogan House. Rest his beautiful soul. I can see the lift, and I'll go up to the second floor, and the production team will be there, and they'll say, okay, this is what we're thinking of. And then on we go. How could there be anything better, you know?
Always nice to talk to you, Jeremy. Thank you very much indeed for doing so this morning. Thank you.
Cheers, Stephen. Thank you so much.
All the very best. That's Jeremy Vine. His book is called What I Learned, What My Listeners Say, and Why We Should Take Notice.